Okay, we've got our esteemed panel back up here. And what we'd like to do now is ask for volunteers. We really don't want to resort to the Socratic method here and call on people. So if people would like to volunteer to share from their tables, we've got these two microphones set up. And then looks like Mary Margaret has got the roaming microphone if somebody doesn't want to come forward. But we'd like to hear what your questions are and your policy ideas, policy change ideas. So who wants to volunteer first? Oh, okay, I'm sorry. I have to pick my boss first. I really want to be here for a long time. So, Scott, yes. There's Mary Margaret.
Well, we didn't do very good with the question because Hill was out here keeping us from being focused. But the question I would ask is, part of the problem in coming up with our question for you is the waterfront you covered today and the inability we have to bring that form or bring that learning to a focused point where we can actually cooperate or triage and use it. So I guess the question is, have you experienced the silos visiting, or is there a place other than, is there a place where we are actually using this knowledge and getting cost benefit or cost avoidance from it?
Yes.
That was pretty clear.
That was very definitive.
We are, I think that in Multnomah County, we're a pretty collaborative community. We do lots working together. On the juvenile side, we've been a JDAI site for 19 years, a detention reform site. And that brought us together to really look at how do we use a scarce resource in the right way for the right kids at the right time. And that really has, I think, has led us to many, many other opportunities. And where we are really looking at bringing different systems together, and we've done it successfully, is through the wraparound model. And I think that the work that is being done, so wraparound is for kids with intense mental health needs who are involved in multiple systems, having a facilitated planning with a facilitator who can really put the family and the youth in the center of the planning, have them direct the planning, and then develop an individualized plan. We had a pilot for a number of years. The county has now taken over wraparound and about a year and a half into it, and it's being successful in terms of coming up with individualized plans that meet the needs of the youth and family, where the youth and family are really at the center of directing. All of our systems have come to the table and put resources and people and money on the table. The school districts, OYA, juvenile justice, mental health, DHS. So I look at that and I think that can happen to a very difficult group. Further down the line, in terms of the crossover youth practice model, DHS, kids who are duly involved in child welfare and juvenile delinquency. We've been part of a practice model along with 11 other states. Marion County is also now part of the practice model, where we are putting together a procedure model to require that people actually confer and talk and come to the hearings together. That's a, it seems like a small step, but it is a big step towards actually planning together, having a plan that makes sense from the perspective of both systems and from the child and family. Both of those are built upon principles of family engagement, family voice being at the table, looking at making sure that we have culturally responsive services available to families. So I think that there are things, and in my mind's eye, when I listen to the whole conversation today, what I see is that we need to continue to build our entire continuum from prevention and prenatal all the way through kids truly entering adulthood, which isn't 18, it's more in someplace in the 20s. And the governor's plan with the 0 to 20 education plan, I think, is a great place for us to really be continuing to build that continuum and make progress towards having that full continuum in place. So I'm cautiously optimistic, especially considering the economic times, and I think this is one where crisis has both created the opportunity and gotten people to realize that they can leap into the abyss and see if it can work.
Judge Waller, I would ask, oh, I'm sorry.
No.
I would ask you to consider two other aspects that may be included in your wraparound plan, but you just didn't mention. One is to include domestic violence. And the second is to get CASA involved. Our CASA in Cook County is involved in having an older youth component, that they've changed some of the trainings for the CASA volunteers, but they also focus on older youth service-based, community-based programs. And so I would ask you to also try to incorporate those two aspects if you've not.
Our CASAs are involved in our wraparound teams.
Great.
For kids and for all of you, I can't give you any of the data because I don't keep it in my head, but we have evaluation looking at, are we slowing down the numbers of placement changes for kids? Are we keeping them safe in the community so that they're not entering detention? Are we keeping them in school? And how do they feel that they are doing? And on all of those, we are showing that we are making progress. I just had one of the original pilot pioneers come to see me, and she's doing really well. She is a child who had 38 placements after a horrific failed adoptive placement. And she is in school, off of supervision, happy, and with some true goals in mind. She's planning on applying to colleges. So I look at that and I think, terrible what happened under my watch to her, but terrific that now we have a plan that's really working.
I just want to sort of contribute my two cents to what I think is a good question. Karen has it exactly right. Probably the most powerful protective factor that we're in a position to impact is school. Schooling is a wonderful, powerful, protective influence for students across the board. There's schooling and then there's schooling. And the PBIS model that Karen talked about that's implemented increasingly in school districts around the country has a wonderful impact on the ecology of schools and classrooms where it's applied. Currently, there are 16,000 plus schools in the U.S. that have adopted this model. Educators really like it. Parents, to the extent that they know about it, really like it, and it works. And one of the things it does is narrows the gap between allocated instructional minutes and actual minutes students are instructed. So the more teachers have to deal with disciplinary challenges and issues and so forth and so on, the fewer instructional minutes are going to be taken advantage of, expanding that gap. So the goal is to reduce the gap between allocated and actually instructed time in the classroom. One more reason to look at the ecology of schools is Shep Kellum is a psychiatrist at Johns Hopkins. He's one of the finest researchers on schools, if you can imagine, in this country. And he did occasionally you see a study that just sort of knocks you over. And for me, it's as follows. He did a study where he identified something like 80 students in grade one. And the criteria that he used were measures of aggression and measures of very disruptive behavior. So he had 80 students, mostly boys, who were very aggressive and very disruptive. Then he coded the ecologies of the classrooms, the first grade classrooms that they were in, and followed them up in middle school when they were in the eighth grade. And you know what? The group that whose first classroom experience, that is in year one, was in a well-managed, well-taught, orderly type classroom, it wasn't chaotic, were far less aggressive and far less disruptive than the students whose first classroom experience was chaos, teacher yelling, things out of control, very, very poor instruction because of all of the disciplinary challenges. So there are just lots of reasons to support teachers in creating positive, engaging, well-managed classrooms. But that, for me, is a really powerful one. I sound like I'm preaching. I'm sorry.
Did anyone else on the panel want to respond to that question? No? Okay. Who else would like to ask a question? Oh.
It works. I just want to preface my question with an observation that when we started out, I noticed that there were only about two working police officers in the group today, and for in the picture, the police officers are the means by which cases come to the juvenile court and to social services, oftentimes, and they're a large part of the equation, large part of the budget equation as well, but so not a part of the discussion and the training that takes place, at least in this sphere here. So I was thinking of just asking generally if somebody could respond to describing a restorative justice model to include police neighborhood officers within the community, a hypothetical model perhaps. And do we talk about these recommendations right now, or we do that later?
Well, why don't we let the panel respond to your first question, okay. Then we can go ahead and talk about the recommendations in a few minutes. Thanks. I don't want to call on anybody, but I'm thinking Jonathan might be able to respond to this question. So how's that for putting it on the spot?
Just put me on the spot. Well, in terms of a hypothetical model, and one of the reasons I think that Christina thought that I could speak to this question is that in several meetings we had yesterday, I alluded to, in a meeting with a police officer, alluded to some work that I'd done with the Honolulu Police Department. And it was built around their Weed and Seed program and four primary police officers. Wouldn't necessarily call it a restorative justice framework, but the model worked by, first of all, taking police officers through about 3 or 4 days of intensive training and understanding youth development, et cetera. Then secondly, linking them up with community resources and programs. Let me tell you why that's important, because the key element of the strategy was that we would provide for law enforcement alternatives to arrest. That it's great to ask police officers to not arrest. It's great to say to them, we're arresting too many of them. But understanding the police mindset and what they're trained to do and what their oath is and that they're public safety minded, it also requires saying to an officer, when I opt not to arrest in a situation where normally I would or I have the discretion to do so, if I don't, what then happens? And can I be assured that public safety is still protected after that arrangement is made? So an important piece of the hypothetical model is having community-based organizations prepared to take what we call direct referrals. And that is a police officer on the street in the midst of field interrogation has in his or her pocket a card with several key agencies on it, and I would say to them, the only thing is you need to know the name of the person at the Boys and Girls Club. One program is called the Targeted Outreach Program, and you need to have at least visited the program and have had some face-to-face contact. And so in that moment, what the officer is able to do is to pull out his cell phone or whatever, and instead of effecting the arrest, actually make a phone call and say, look, I've got Susie here. Third time I've seen her on the streets. I'm bringing her over to the Boys and Girls Club. You guys can take it from here. Arrest not made, didn't have to do the processing downtown, and then release, because sometimes the processing downtown with the fingerprinting and the picture, that's traumatic in and of itself. The record is there, and it's added in a very negative file to the file system. We want to avoid creating negative files as far as we possibly can, so long as public safety is protected. And so that piece of the model is, and I won't talk much further about it, but the piece of the model is having enough partners in place so that officers can make those kinds of referrals. Positive thing that happened, by the way, in Honolulu is that the connection with the community became so strong because of that kind of work, because they knew things to provide youth with, give them opportunities to grow, to develop those sparks, is that the young people themselves came to the police because they were having these rave parties on Saturday night. And at the rave, talk about the CSEC population, commercial sex exploitation of children. At the rave parties, young girls were being exploited by having their drinks spiked and were being missing for 1 or 2 days at a time. Brought this information to the police officers because of relationships that were built. Then these police officers went to the detective division, who did a sting operation and went in. Awesome police work. And actually ended up having the place closed down. Once that happened, it just sent positive signals across the whole police department because they understood that by building these kinds of connections and saving kids' lives, we police better.
Great. Yeah, I would just, I guess I would add in the RJ specific school context, it's having the school resource officers, the SROs, actually part of the RJ, but not as the person who's claiming or saying, you harmed me, or you've broken a law, but part of the entire process, right? So that the harm is about the harm against maybe another individual or the school community as a whole, but they're still integrated into that process. I think the other model is the model that we've seen here in Portland and other places where officers are holding tickets, right, in lieu of, or not suspending and holding tickets and doing the RJs. Not themselves, but actually having the RJs happen. And then if there's compliance or non-compliance, then ultimately going down the pathway of issuing the ticket or something else. So instead of that arrest in that moment, right? So it's being engaged in the actual process. In Denver and in North in particular with Officer Chavez, he actually does RJs himself as well now and mediates between students. And he gets to use his power and his prestige as being the SRO to his advantage, whether I agree with that or not, right? In that he's like, well, you should do this RJ, because if not, I mean, I just might have to take you both in, right? I hear this from students, and I'm like, oh, God, I don't want to know this, right? But he uses that moment, right, to encourage then that facilitation. And again, I think I spoke about how he's part of that school community, he's viewed that as that school community, and I think that that is an important component. And you have to have the schools have ownership and accountability and include officers in the school community. I think referring to them as faculty is a big and significant shift, right? It's that idea that they are part of the entire school community, they are there with respect to safety, but also everything else that's happening. So I think those models exist in non-hypothetical forms as well.
I wanted to just give another example of what the benefits might be of having that model and in using our police officers as intermediaries that has worked in our district. This is a very real situation that happened this year. The kids had reported to the principal that they knew that there was going to be a giant fight over the, not on the weekend, but the Monday coming back. And so because there's a good relationship with the kids and the principal, that was reported to her. She immediately went to the restorative justice caseworker and the SRO, both of them, they were kind of as a team, and kind of spoke about what was the rumor. Over the weekend, the officer and the restorative justice person went to the households of the kids that were supposed to fight and actually sat down and mediated with both sets of parents. This was actually racial. and had some horrible potential for being really awful. And because there's a relationship there, and it has a reputation for being restorative, they were able to mediate over the weekend, and nothing happened. So that's a great example of having relationships with people, having relationships with our officers, and how you develop that. And frankly, it does take training. It's a different mindset, and it takes time.
Great. Thanks. Suzanne, did you have a question?
Are we going on to our question for our table? Because I don't want to cut anybody off if you're still responding to that question.
No. Did anyone else want to respond? Okay. No, I think we're good.
Okay, so we just had this question. If we all know what works to divert kids from the juvenile justice system and the adult criminal justice system, what are the barriers and how do we overcome them from making it happen? It's just a simple question. So.
Wow. Did anyone tell you it's 4 o'clock on a Friday afternoon?
Yeah.
Okay, who wants to respond to that one?
I'll start. Okay. And I think it's political will. I don't know how to say it pretty, but it's political will. If we just took the resources we are using today, and we all have had contracted budgets, but if we just took the resources we had today, sat around and thought about allocating them according to our priorities, and then followed through, I would imagine that our day would have been vastly different today. So I would say it's political will. Now, I think here you're very fortunate. You have a governor who's given some preliminary, I assume I'm not speaking out of school, I assume this is public knowledge. Nice time to ask, huh? You have a governor who's made some commitments to have the 0 to 20 wraparound program that sounds phenomenal. And I hope when you invite me back, if I haven't been so bad, that it will actually be in place and we can start talking about the successes you've realized from this. But when you start talking about what we know, you're right. We've talked about the answers to most of the problems right here in this room today. It takes us putting the executive branch together with the legislative branch and actually putting, you know, our money where our mouth is.
I think it also takes something else besides, I agree absolutely, it takes political will. But for the kinds of things that were being discussed today, it also takes a change in each of us as community members, in terms of how we view our responsibilities to the children in our communities. There is, you know, the Search Institute and other research on resiliency. It doesn't cost money for adults to take the time to put into children, to develop relationships, to know the names of. And there's research that out of one of the Seattle school districts a number of years ago, where they had an actual research group and a control group. And the research group, the principal greeted children, mm-hmm. I think it was kindergarten through fifth grade, hello, how are you today, and knew their names. The control group, the principal didn't say hello to in the morning. Now that's a pretty simple, zero cost, very little time. You know, it takes the time to be the difference. Moment. And they were able to show in the study that they did that there were still result differences in 12th grade, so this was kindergarten through fifth grade, in academic achievement and attendance and other, along another other kind of positive youth behavior. That's really simple. The Search Institute research shows that if you get kids, you have enough assets for children, enough caring adults, a caring school environment, positive social activities for kids to be involved in, that it can be an inoculation against kids engaging in risky behavior. But that takes that's a social norm of adults spending time with children and recognizing that they really have a responsibility, not only to their own children, but also to their own children. When years ago we did a, we surveyed 10,000 children in Multnomah County, 8th grade, 10th grade, 12th grade, using the search instrument on resiliency and assets. And our kids didn't have enough assets. It didn't matter if they were from rich schools, poor schools, east of the river, west of the river. Didn't matter. None of them had enough assets because they're, many of them were about how much time adults are putting into them, whether they see adults as caring. What was really tragic was that 75% of the kids surveyed, our children, said that they didn't think that adults liked teenagers. At the same time, there was a national survey of adults. And guess what? Our kids were right on in there.
We don't like it.
They're like, no, not teenagers.
They're afraid of it.
So I would agree it's political will, but it's also changing the social norm about how we view children and our responsibility to children.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. I'd like to call your attention in your packet to the DVD. There's a handout in there called Tips for Parents on Parenting. And it describes and gives examples of the five parenting practices that represent the DNA of effective socialization and rearing of children. And I'll just give you a quick listing of them. They're careful monitoring of where your children are, what they're doing, who they're doing it with. Two, discipline that is predictable, consistent, never harsh or punitive, and occurs appropriately in relation to the situation that calls for it. Three, parent involvement. Your child, if at all possible, should have a certain amount of time with you every day. Even if it's only 5 minutes, it's their time. They own it. They have a right. Three, the use of positive family management techniques of encouragement, support, negotiation. It's far better to say, I want you to do this for the following reason or reasons than to say, you should do it because I told you to, which I've done many times in my own life as a parent. And finally, crisis intervention. Your child should know that if they have a crisis, no matter how small, they can bring it to you. You'll problem solve with them. You'll take them through it. You'll support them, develop alternatives, and so on. And finally, every day of your child's life, if at all possible, you should have a debriefing session. What was your day like? What was good? What was not good? Oh, there were some things that weren't good. What are those? By the way, you'll find out things you'd never find out otherwise. But how did you respond to the things that didn't go well? So you're teaching them all the development of alternative strategies and problem solving, which is so healthy. But you have to start early. If you spring it on them when they're in middle school, it's not going to work. So I just want to add to the conversation that if the U.S. Public Health Service could take that on as a mission and just infuse it throughout our society, it could do amazing things.
I guess I would add, you know, we talk about models of practice up here, so we're talking about good things that are happening. But this kind of goes to your question or candid point about IEPs is that schools need to be more transparent about their policies and practices. Parents need to know that they have a right in certain instances. And so I think that the idea of shifting norms is also about shifting norms in terms of dignity of parents, and that parents have a right to participate in the process that is impacting their youth and their children. And it may not be their kids, right? Many of the communities that I work in, it's not a parent who's raising the child who is having an issue in the school, right? It is a secondary or tertiary caregiver. And so, you know, I think that it's great that we can love what we're talking about and the models that we're giving, but these are the exceptions in many instances across this country. So I would say, you know, systemic shift is also about acknowledging where we aren't doing good and starting to make that change. You know, moving away from punitive discipline, moving away from policies that don't engage parents, that don't give transparency to parents, and allow for that process to really happen. So,
great. Thank you, Dr. Gonzalez. Dr. Gray, did you have anything you wanted to add? Okay. I think in the interest of time, I want to make sure we shift to the policy recommendations. And the gentleman who asked about law enforcement and restorative justice, did you want to share what you had with us?
I have retrained neighborhood officers in discretion and incident evaluation to reduce indiscriminate and casual low-level arrests that generate court action or disposal, in other words, court clutter. And restore youth divisions to police jurisdiction with appropriate training in social service and family-centered intervention. And C, include selectively trained police officers in participation in multidisciplinary teams as allowed with consideration to confidentiality laws.
Great. Did anybody on the panel want to respond to any of that?
I'd like to respond to the first one. At our table, we talked about something very similar to that policy, specifically as it relates to drugs. And I was saying in Chicago, the city proper, we've reduced simple marijuana possession to a city ordinance, so you can no longer get jail time. It's no longer a misdemeanor, it's a fine-only offense. So why aren't we doing that with our kids? Why aren't we taking nonviolent drug offenses with our kids and treating them as an illness as opposed to an arrest? And there were issues brought up, practical issues around this that we would have to talk about, you know, making certain and ensuring that the treatment modalities actually had some evidence-based validity to it and like. But the issue really is, rather than arresting for an illness, why aren't we now looking at preventive opportunities to make certain that if it is a gateway drug, making certain that we prevent opening that gate, making certain that we're not building arrest for nonviolent offenses that we ourselves don't think that they're punishable by misdemeanor standards for adults, and making certain that we preclude our children from getting those arrests that start them down that trajectory of arrest, going from heavier misdemeanors to felonies.
Did anyone else on the panel have a comment to that? Did anyone else have a recommendation for a policy change that they'd like to share?
Are those policy recommendations going to be turned in at some point so we can look?
Yes, we're going to collect those sheets. Okay. Come on, we must have something. We've got a few more minutes left.
I feel like it's 4:15.
Yeah.
Yes, policy recommendations. I guess listen to the political will. I don't know whose political will it is. I see a lot of great individuals here that have influence in, as far as those who write laws. I always find it interesting, but that's only because that's who I am as a Native person and the kind of work I work. I work at a state agency, kid prison, I call it, and youth correctional facility. But I have issues with the way Measure 11 works. And we're talking about resources and how it's obvious, like in California, you know, three strikes, you're out. And all those places that have those kind of laws are breaking the states. And these resources, this money could be used for these things that we're all talking about. We could redirect this kind of resources like that. So I was just wondering, does it apply evidence-based or best practice into laws? If they had applied that to Measure 11, does it work? You know, so I always wonder, how can we implement that kind of thinking into our political will? If we can have some kind of influence like that. Anybody have anything to say about that?
I don't know much about the 11 you're talking about, but I think there's
always been a disconnect between the research and what happens in practice. I think that's everywhere. I think there's a lot of us who have some clarity around what the research and the literature is suggesting to us, and oftentimes we don't get that into practice. I think we're doing better about that, but I think there is that disconnect, and I think we have to do a better job making certain that the research... That's why this morning I was congratulating this body on bringing researchers and sitting down and talking about the things that we need so that they can help us understand what their conclusions are and how we can start utilizing those conclusions to improve our practices and do better. But I would agree with you, all across the nation, we need to do better in actually taking the information we know and translating that into programs that are effective for our families and our children.
Yeah, because I, for myself, I see that if somebody does something wrong, that the punishment should actually kind of fit the crime. I work with a lot of kids that some of the stuff that actually did, really, they shouldn't even be there, but it fell into the Measure 11 aspect, so they got to spend their 5-7 years of their life there. And somewhere along the line, they're young and whatever that word is, that S word, they're young and the thing is they made a mistake because they thought that's what it meant to be young in America. And the next thing they find themselves incarcerated and then they wake up one day and go, oh my God, what have I done? And they start to realize those little connections that we were talking about here that happens in the brain, they start realizing that, they were in the wrong path and they don't belong there anymore, but oh, wait a minute. According to Measure 11, you still have to spend this much time in there. And at the long run, now I'm ruining him, or he's being ruined. I'm not doing it. I'm trying to help him. But the thing is, they spend too much time there, and now we took away his right as a citizen. He can't get a job because he's a felon. He can't buy a home. He can't go to school. Can't go to college. There's a lot of things that we take away. So we are eliminating citizens that we need us, that we need to vote for us, unless we don't want them to vote for us. But we're segregating our own citizens in the state. And in time, if this keeps up, there's only going to be a handful of people that control everything. And most of them are going to be out of a job.
I think that's at 99 cents.
That's right. 99.
Yes, Hill, did you want to respond to that?
Just to respond a bit to your point, human beings are rational creatures, and they're also emotional creatures. And I was really encouraged to see this morning the number of research analysts and policy advisors in this room. And I think you're in a great position to look at what we can say we know about certain practices. And there are meta-analyses that synthesize large volumes of studies and boil them down and tell us what they show, as a large body. For example, you can do meta-analyses of studies of the relationship between the length of incarceration for youth and certain outcomes, prevention outcomes and so forth and so on. That's a reality that can be documented objectively. But then there are a large number of people who are gatekeepers that don't want to believe that. That's not what they want to believe. Therefore, they will not. So, we're not constrained, unfortunately, as I wish we were more so, by the facts. There are facts. And then there are people who will get really passionate about it, and they'll try to find a way to denigrate or deny the facts or provide some rationale for not accepting them. So, I see Measure 11 as falling in that bailiwick. Not telling you anything you don't already know.
Judge Martin, did you have another comment?
No, okay. I'm fine, thank you.
Okay. There is a Peter O'Zan's on the commission that's looking at sentencing practices in the state. So it will be interesting to see what recommendations come out of that.
Well, actually, I'm not on the commission. I'm working with the staff. And I think some of them are here. But they're due. The report, the first report,
is due.
Reports
due to the governor Thursday the 15th. Next week.
They've actually promoted ideas here. So it'll be interesting to see, and I assume that there may be recommendations around some of the issues that are being discussed today.
I can speak out of school about it because I'm not in school. Dave probably is constrained. I would predict that the commission
chaired by the Chief Justice will ask the governor and the legislature for authorization to proceed. This is only a guess, but to proceed. To proceed to spend a year reviewing sentencing law in Oregon, including Measure 11, and report to the 2013 legislature with a set of new recommendations. For those of you who aren't in Oregon, one of the most serious problems we have is a parallel provision in our law that says any changes in sentencing law has to be voted in place by two-thirds of the legislature. So we have a lot of political work to do in that regard.
Shannon, I think we have time for one last comment.
I just wanted to add to that conversation, because that Commission on Public Safety will continue to have probably public meetings, and that this is a body that should make their voice heard there. You know, if folks want to do something about Measure 11, they're pretty adult-focused, as we all know who do juvenile justice work, that people end up focusing on adults more than kids. And so I would encourage folks to think about being in touch with those commissioners or providing public testimony if you have concerns about things you want changed.
Thank you. Well, I think I'm getting the sign from Mary Margaret that we're out of time, so I think this is where Commissioner Shiprack comes back up. So thank you all for your thoughts and sharing your comments with us.